from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up in this next Forum Hour, as we approach the 10-year mark following the 9/11 attacks, we speak this hour with members of the Bay Area Muslim community. How have the lives of local Muslims changed over the past decade? And are tensions between Muslims and non-Muslims improving, or are they declining? Forum is next. We'll include your calls, emails, and online responses after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. As part of our ongoing series on 9/11, 10 years after, we discuss in this Forum Hour relations between Muslims and non-Muslims. There are an estimated 6 to 8 million Muslims living in the United States, over 200,000 here in the Bay Area. How have their lives changed over the past decade, and are the tensions between Muslims and non-Muslims in the Bay Area improving or declining? Joining us by phone this morning is Jess Ganim. He's professor of clinical psychiatry and global health at the University of California, San Francisco, and a board member of the National Association of Arab Americans, former director of the Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee of San Francisco. Good to have you with us, Professor Jess Ganim.
Thank you, Michael.
Here in studio with us is Amina Jandali, founding member of the Islamic Network Group. We'll say good morning to you. Welcome.
Good morning. Thank you.
Also say good morning to Zara Bilou, Executive Director of the Council on American-Islamic Relations, San Francisco Bay Area. CARE is the largest American Muslim versus Islamic civil liberties group. Good morning. Welcome to the program.
Good morning.
And Mary Payman is with us as well this morning here in studio, trustee member of the Islamic Cultural Center of Northern California. They're located in downtown Oakland, and we welcome you. Good morning.
Good morning.
Let me begin, Jess Ganim, with you. From what we've been able to, at this point, conclude, things have moved in very good directions in terms of better interfaith relations and the efforts that have been made on that score. But as far as just the kind of scrutiny that's coming, CIA agents and mosques and infiltrating and all that sort of thing, things are not necessarily looking so positive.
Michael, I think it is a tale of two cities right now. In fact, since 10 years ago, 9/11, we've seen tremendous growth in terms of interfaith relations, other communities reaching out to our community, a significant increase in the number of cultural and, you know, competencies that we've been able to provide to local groups and things like that, people wanting to know more about our community and Islam. It's been really tremendous. So from that perspective, we can be very thankful about, you know, these positive developments. However, if you look at the other side of it, it is kind of disturbing in so many ways. I mean, if you look at the presidential candidates right now, many of them have been given free rein to be incredibly xenophobic. You look at Alan West's comments recently, they're profoundly disturbing, frankly xenophobic, and at times even frankly racist. You have the recent, description of the CIA working hand in hand with the New York Police Department. We know that there are multiple surveillance projects going on, targeting specifically mosques and the Muslim community here in the United States. So we'd really have to say that it's a tale of two cities. It's a lot of positive growth and development, but at the same time, our community continues to be targeted.
On the positive side, though, is it fair to say that people generally don't have an understanding overall in the United States and even here in the Bay Area about what Islam is or isn't?
Well, I think in general we've seen a significant amount of growth in that, not the least of which, you know, we have to thank Amina and Zahra for their tremendous work that they've done in the last 10 years here in the Bay Area. But there's still a lot of room to grow. We still see a lot of misconceptions. A number of us who are on the panel today have been working very closely with the mayor's office and the chief of police, former and current, to really try to dispel a lot of misinformation and misunderstanding about what's happening in our community. So although we've come a long way, I still think there's a long way to go.
Again, Jess Ganim is professor of clinical psychiatry and global health at UCSF and a board member of the National Association of Arab Americans, former director of Arabs Anti-Discrimination Committee of San Francisco. And Amina Jindali is founding member of the Islamic Network Group. And let's talk a bit about, well, Islamophobia. I mean, has it decreased with this greater understanding and all this outreach and the good tale of the two cities?
I mean, I really agree with Jess that it's the good and the bad together, and it's kind of ironic. So as he said, after 9/11, immediately amazing opportunities for outreach, for interfaith. And in our organization, you know, we had been doing about 500-600 presentations a year, and it spiked to something like 800, over 800 in 2002, and that gradually went back to normal. But I think just the opening of doors that had not really been there, this sudden interest in Islam, and whether it's from the Kiwanis Club, the Rotaries Club, interfaith organizations, that had not really been there before 9/11. So
there is greater understanding of Islam, and there's a more enlightenment, more
illumination. For some people. Yeah. And then for others, it's been an opportunity to kind of bash Islam and to bring out all of the negative stereotypes that had been kind of dormant. They were there before. We can't say that these all began with 9/11, but bringing them to the fore and obviously vigorous campaigns, well-funded campaigns to really push this agenda for political and other reasons. So it's a good story and it's a bad story.
Actually, apropos of what you just said, I'm looking at a report that was sent to me by a listener earlier this morning. You may know about it was conducted by the American Progress Association, mm-hmm. and it says that literally millions of dollars have been spent. Now, I don't know how these are quantified, but on essentially stirring up hatred and bigotry against Islam.
Yeah, some $42 million, and the report details exactly where each came from. So
they single out individuals like Daniel Pipes and Stephen Emerson. I mean, but there's sometimes a difficult line in determining. Maybe we ought to talk about this because CARE has certainly received a lot of attention on this score. How do you determine what is Islamophobic or what is bigotry or what is hatred? It's sometimes a pretty slippery slope, isn't it?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I think that we like to make the distinction between people who have sincere questions and fears about the unknown and then people who are sort of manipulating those fears for their own personal gain to perpetuate prejudice and bigotry. And I think that that's an important distinction. Time magazine showed in 2010 that over 60% of Americans still had not met a Muslim. They had no personal connection to Islam or Muslims. And so there's going to be concerns and fears there because they're getting their information from Fox News. They're getting their information from Daniel Pipes and Steve Emerson. And so it's important on our end as American Muslims to get out and do more outreach. But there's also people like Steve Emerson, like Alan West, like Congressman Peter King, who are using that fear of the unknown to perpetuate bigotry.
And this, by the way, is Zara Billow, who's executive director of the Council on American Islamic Relations of the San Francisco Bay Area. CARE is the largest American Muslim civil liberties group. You're wearing a headscarf, and I wanted to just bring this to a personal level with some of you. Wearing a headscarf became more of a expression of who you are as a Muslim, and yet after 9/11, it seemed to go two ways as well. We're talking about all this dichotomy. There were a lot of Muslims who said, I'm proud, I'm wearing this. In fact, there were even T-shirts I read about that said, you know, go ahead, profile me, these kinds of things, you know, taken to a sort of an extreme. And yet you had a lot of people who were very frightened in the Muslim community. How does this 10 years later seem to you?
I mean, it's still a very fine line. People are still very afraid for different reasons to be sort of out and open about their faith, whether it's their headscarf or even attending a mosque. When we see concerns about law enforcement profiling individuals who attend mosques on a regular basis, it's the same sort of concern, or it's a parallel concern to, you know, is my employer going to let me keep this job because of my headscarf? Am I going to be the victim of a hate crime because of my headscarf? And I think going back to the good and the bad, we get a lot of public support from people who will reach out and just, you know, I really like your headscarf today, or, you know, I really support you in what you're doing. And then you have, of course, the risk of sort of the few individuals who act out in sort of manifesting hate, scaring the larger community.
And then on a broader, larger community question, Mary Payman, and Mary Payman is here in studio with us as well, trustee member of the Islamic Cultural Center of Northern California, and they're located in downtown Oakland. One gets a sense now that there is a movement afoot politically. I mean, all these Sharia laws or laws opposing Sharia, for example, how does that affect the community?
Well, Islamic Cultural Center of Northern California, which is in, located downtown Oakland, is a community-based organization. And we started this model 15 years ago, and basically we were very active in interfaith program. And through that, we probably did much better job post 9/11 because there were a lot of churches and synagogues and temples that knew about us and knew what we were standing for and what we were partners in social welfare program with these other organizations. So our organization basically has a couple of partners, it's Presbyterian Church of Montclair and Kahila Synagogue in Piedmont, Oakland. And we try to focus on common points through Abrahamic faith, and we find various occasions to celebrate things that we have in common. And we try to stay away from these political issues and focus really on our communities and educate each other about our faith and try to identify commonalities between these Abrahamic faith, and that's been quite successful.
Well, you're in good company. Michael Oren, in fact, United States Ambassador to Israel, celebrating his residence, a meal that was prepared under Islamic law and all of that with the Muslim chief, the Muslim chef making sure that everything was done right with a lot of dignitaries from the Islamic world. And this is probably the good side that we've been talking about, that you're talking about here. But there is all this fear and concern about things like Sharia. Now, you're from a Shia background, right?
Yes.
And there's also a perception of a lot of division, not only between Muslims and people of other faiths that has to be ameliorated, but between Muslims themselves, Shia and Sunni.
Well, I think my understanding of these issues between interfaith is also due to lack of education of people about their religions. Not only a lot of non-Muslims don't know a whole lot about Islam, there are a lot of Muslims in the world that don't know much about their own faith as well. And so one of the things that we focus on and we work with Amina and Zahra on this is try to educate each other and have intra-faith program as well. And I think our model has been quite successful. There are a lot of programs that we have in common and try to address these issues that are due to lack of education. So we try to...
You can only send YouTubes over to Iraq and get everybody to see them, right? Now, I'm not trying to be funny here, but the fact of the matter is there's a lot of maybe more goodwill and amity here than there is in places where these divisions are much more pronounced in the Middle East. You know?
Well, a lot of these divisions are actually not religious. They're political, because if you look at Iraq, you know, before the fall of Saddam, you had families that were intermarried for decades and centuries. And so a lot of this was because of the shift in power. Here, obviously, we don't have that. But I think having an organization like ICCNC doing outreach to all communities, and we've really seen that blossoming over the last 10 years as well, where a lot of organizations as well as mosques are now working together in a way that they didn't before. So part of that is I think having the right people in charge who really have an understanding that pluralism is interfaith and interfaith as well.
You being sort of more reaching out, or are they reaching out more to you, interfaith communities?
Interfaith, right? I mean, it's really both. At ING, we actually initiated something that has not really been done before. We've had the Islamic Speakers Bureau since 1993, but then in 2007, we initiated the Interfaith Speakers Bureau, where we go out and seek representatives of the five major world religions, and we send them out to do the same work that we've been doing to schools and to different organizations to talk about all the faiths. So we have that going on. At the same time, we have a lot of faith organizations, obviously, you know, looking for that place at the table where prior to 9/11, you know, the Muslim spot was empty. There wasn't a chair. And now they're realizing that it has to be complete. And even, you know, on an academic level, you have a lot. You have this booming of Islamic studies. I've been teaching at San Francisco City College since 2005. And UC Berkeley, you know, has always had a department, but the GTU just recently opened a Center for Islamic Studies. And you have this going on across the country. So there's this booming interest in Islam, in Arabic, that I think was not there before 9/11 as well.
What about, because it always comes up from people who in some instances are well-meaning and in some instances not terribly enlightened, about Sharia. I mean, again, the attempt to politically make laws, a number of states have, outlawing Sharia.
Well, that would be like outlawing, you know, the halakha for Jews or catechism for Christians. What people don't realize is that if you're a practicing Muslim who's praying and fasting, you know, fasting Ramadan, that's following the Sharia. Every time I go pray, you know, the way I put my hands up, the way I bend down, that's following the Sharia. So when most people think of Sharia, these red lights go off because they're thinking of these horrific crimes they hear about overseas, but they don't realize that that's a very small and manipulated, extreme use of Sharia. The majority of the rules around Sharia are what you eat, you know, eating the halal meat like you talked about, Michael Oren, you know, he was following Sharia when he got that halal meat. Laying the prayer rugs for his guests to pray, as I imagine he did. So he was following Sharia.
It's like the word jihad in many ways, isn't it?
I mean, exactly.
It becomes a word that's fraught with all kinds of meaning that people attribute to it that doesn't necessarily have much to do with the theology.
Right, and in fact,
it.
A lot of Jews are worried about these Sharia bans because it might impact them as well. And this country was founded on religious freedom. That is what makes this country unique in the history of the world.
You mean like outlawing circumcision in San Francisco?
Exactly.
That's where Muslims and Jews came together.
They absolutely came together, yeah.
I mean, I think even just as an example in the Sharia and interfaith sort of building, there's a case being litigated in Oklahoma right now because that was the first state that passed a Sharia ban, and they did it based on a ballot measure. And so it's being challenged in the courts there, and it was really inspiring to see the National Baptist Organization and the Anti-Defamation League submit amicus briefs or friends of the court briefs to the court saying, you know, even we oppose the Sharia ban here.
Just, Ganim, if I can go back to you, just maybe from an overview standpoint, as I said earlier, there are 200,000 Muslims here in the Bay Area. Most sociologists will tell you that prejudice and tensions have to do with population concentrations to a great degree. And a lot of this anti-Muslim feeling, I imagine, is more regional based on, well, for example, there's probably a lot more discrimination, I would imagine, around Dearborn, Michigan than there is maybe here in the Bay Area.
I'm not sure that's necessarily true, Michael, because we get reports of a lot of challenging confrontations with people in our community in less densely populated areas. There's a very well-known case in Tennessee, for example, of a local community wanting to build an Islamic center with a school and a community center. And it's not a huge community by any stretch of the imagination, and yet they're being met with significant and vociferous challenges to this and, you know, ballot measures and protests wanting to close the center down, and that's a relatively low-density community. Here in the Bay Area, which we like to think, for example, is a bastion of progressive ideas and inclusiveness, you know, we continue to have many difficulties and many challenges, and I may defer to Zahra a little bit later, but, you know, the GPS case of a young Muslim man who had the FBI put a GPS device in his car, that's a Bay Area thing. We also have a number of individuals who have been fired from their jobs or let go from their jobs because of wearing traditional Islamic clothing. You'd be surprised to hear that Dearborn, which has the highest concentration, actually has situated itself in such a way that we don't get a lot of problems in Dearborn, Michigan, ironically. So I think a lot of it just depends on local dynamics.
And Amiri Payman, what about the sense of security of those attending mosques now, 10 years later?
Well, I'd like to go back 10 years ago and explain to you through reaching out outside of Muslim community from the start of the organization. The first Friday after September 11, 2001, a large group of people from Montclair Presbyterian Church and Kehila Synagogue showed up to our Friday prayer at the ICCNC. And so I think it was about 200 people. They said, we're going to be here and pray with you. And if someone is going to attack your center, we want to be among you. And fortunately, because of reaching out and doing social welfare program prior to this tragedy, the neighbors have been super nice to us, and they've been sending letters of support and saying, you know, that you guys have been wonderful to our community. And so at least downtown Oakland, there's a sense of security and people feel quite comfortable. As a matter of fact, we had our open house, which is like open mosque, breaking fast with people of other faith 2 weeks ago. And there was about about 500 people showing up of different faith, and it was quite a successful program. So there is a good sense of security, at least in downtown Oakland. So, but I don't know about the rest of Bay Area, and Zahra and Amina could speak to that point.
You want to speak to that point, Zahra, Amina?
I think so. I think it depends on sort of what's going on around the country. I can share that last summer during Ramadan, when the Park 51 controversy was at its height, when the Tennessee Mosque controversy was at its height, mosques across the Bay Area were looking at hiring armed security. People were afraid of who was standing in the shadows as they were leaving prayer services, right? And that's just a fear of hate crimes and hate incidents. But I also mentioned earlier that there's a lot of racial profiling that happens from the law enforcement perspective. So we hear from people also in downtown Oakland and San Jose and San Francisco who were afraid of going to the mosque because they don't want to be labeled a practicing Muslim in a way that may have a detrimental consequence.
Didn't you also express the sense that it's been tougher under this present administration of Barack Obama than it was under George
Bush? Yeah, it's really interesting to note that anti-Muslim sentiment, many would argue, feels higher now, 10 years post 9/11, than even the way it did maybe a month or two following the actual tragedy. And many people have argued that that has a lot to do with the fact that right now sort of the biggest slur or secret or controversy around President Barack Obama is his middle name being Hussein and whether or not he's actually a secret Muslim.
And of course, there were many those who felt that his Cairo speech would be, on the one hand, you know, opening the door to better relations with the Islamic world. But many saw it as an apologist attitude and his bowing to the Saudi. I mean, this is what one reads and hears from the other side of the political spectrum.
Yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right. I think that there are people that are looking for ways to attack Barack Obama and sort of the progress that he is trying to make. And that's one of the openings that they have is his possible religious identity, which, again, is unconfirmed. And probably we won't know till 2016.
So, Amina Jindali, are we in better shape now as we move forward in this 10-year mark?
That's a hard one to answer. I mean, in many ways we are. Going back to my class, I just started a couple weeks ago at San Francisco City College, and we have more students in the class than we've ever had. Now, part of that is the budget cuts. They can't get into other classes. But I go around and ask them, you know, why are you taking the class? And I've noticed that I'd say about a third of the students either have a Muslim friend, or one of the students actually said all of his friends, he's from New York, were Muslim, and that's why he's taking the class. So one thing I think is very important. You know, our children are growing up and their friends are not going to have the same attitudes that people in their 50s or 60s, you know, had because they didn't have a Muslim neighbor, they didn't have a Muslim friend. And so that's something that's very positive. We see a lot of positive things just here in Ramadan. You know, a lot of companies are offering iftar, the fast breaking. It's not just at the White House. This is happening. It's happening across campuses at Berkeley. UC Berkeley's done that for many years. So there's an awareness and an acceptance that I think is unprecedented. And I think that goes with every immigrant community. So we're following the trajectory of other immigrant communities. But at the same time, we have all this other stuff happening.
Or a more openness toward people of color, for example.
Absolutely.
Particularly where civil rights are concerned and once we lived with Jim Crow, and now we don't. In the meantime, let me give out a phone number and invite those of you listening to join us. We do welcome your calls, and we invite you to join this conversation. Our toll-free number is available right now. Whether you're listening on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite, you can join us at 866-733-6786. Again, the number for your calls, 866-733-6786. You can also send an email to us, our email address, forum@kqed.org, or you can post a question or comment on our website simply by going to kqed.org/forum and clicking on this segment. We'll hear from you when we continue talking about 10 years later, Muslims in the Bay Area and relations between Muslims and non-Muslims. Talking with Jess Gannon from UC, with Amina Jindali from the Islamic Network, and with Zahra Bilu from the Muslim Civil Liberties Group, and Amira Payman from downtown Oakland. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Part of our series on 10 years after 9/11, we're talking about the terrorist attacks on 9/11. We're talking this morning in the second hour of Forum with members of the Bay Area Muslim community and asking the question, how have the lives of local Muslims changed over the past decade? And are tensions between Muslims and non-Muslims heightened in the aftermath of 9/11? Are they getting better or worse? With us in studio is Payman Amiri. Let's get that name correct here, and let's get all the bona fides correct. Trustee member of the Islamic Cultural Center of Northern California, which is located in downtown Oakland. Also, Zara Bilu, who is executive director of the Council on American Islamic Relations, San Francisco Bay Area chapter. CARE is the largest American Muslim civil liberties group. Amina Jandali is a founding member of the Islamic Network Group. And Jess Ganim, with us by phone, is professor of clinical psychiatry and global health at UCSF, a board member of the National Association of Arab Americans, and former director of Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee of San Francisco. Go to your calls here in just a moment. Let me go to some emails first. Vince says, I want to say that part of why people are antagonistic towards members of the community could be the lack of outrage from American Muslims when potential acts of terrorism are unveiled. Maybe it is the media's fault, but we all see the rightful outrage and public protests when their rights are restricted. What we do not see is public protests and outrage from them when acts of terrorism are prevented. We did not see Muslims coming out in strength and being outraged when a man in Oregon tried to blow up a Christmas gathering. The perception as a result is that they spend a lot more effort on educating non-Muslims on Islam versus educating at-risk Muslims on why terrorism is against Islam. If they make it more obvious that they are fighting against terrorism, people would be a lot more receptive. And Jess Ganim, let's get your response to that.
Well, you know, we hear this all the time, and we've been hearing it for years, Michael. It's really unfortunate that this keeps being brought up, when in fact, I think, as a community, both here in the Bay Area and throughout the United States and beyond, the Muslim community unequivocally rejects all forms of terrorism, unequivocally rejects all attacks on civilians, you know, of any kind whatsoever. Numerous statements have been made categorically by CARE and by all Muslim organizations, and it's kind of unfortunate that we keep hearing this time and time again. I mean, if truth be told, if you look at what's been happening in the Bay Area, you have large numbers of Arab and Muslim communities coming together, you know, protesting against brutal regimes in their own home countries. So to say that the Muslim community is silent about terrorism is just categorically false. And I think it's used a lot, unfortunately, in the media as a way to otherize, to create this sense of otherness of this community, that somehow we're not on board with this. It's really, truly unfortunate.
One thing that one often hears, again, from those who are critical and I suppose maybe labeled as Islamophobic, Zara Bilu, is the notion that somehow moderate Muslims who voice what we just heard from Jess Ganim don't get enough they're not heard enough, and they don't really have enough of a, shall we say, platform to speak from because of the sense of, well, repression, I guess, from the more extreme elements. Can I address that?
I think it's a two-way street. So I accept the fact that in the last 10 years that there has been a responsibility placed on the American Muslim community to explain the faith, to explain why we condemn the acts of terror, what our religion says about violence against innocents. But I think that the other side of that street is that Americans who are interested and who have these questions also need to get out there. They need to learn. So if the person that had emailed you had simply searched fatwa against terror, he would have found it. It was issued many, many years ago by organizations like CARE and numerous other national organizations that orchestrated it following 9/11. They felt the need to clarify. But at some point, we're going to need to move past this sort of discussion of do you condemn terror, because we've done it over and over and over again.
And we heard, Payman Amiri, from you about how really well the relations have been operating here between Shia and Sunni, at least in the Bay Area. Here's a listener, and Amina, perhaps Amina Jandali, we can hear from you on this too. This is Lee, who says, I'd like to hear comments from your guests on tensions within the Muslim community between moderates and fundamentalists, primarily Wahhabists and Salafists. I've traveled in Indonesia half a dozen times over the last decade, and there I've seen the Wahhabists gaining influence aided by Saudi petrodollars. Is that happening here?
Well, I'm not an authority to speak on that, but I can see from Bay Area Muslim communities and organization, it's much less than you see it worldwide, because as Amina Jandali said, there is no political gain here in these areas. But again, it's all of our responsibilities to educate each other about our faith. So we have to have more intra-faith activities, and we have to reach to other centers and mosques in of different school of thoughts. And but I don't see that, at least in Bay Area, but Amina perhaps is a better place to explain that.
Sure. I would just like to mention back to the question about terrorism, a good resource for people who actually want to see if Muslims have condemned terrorism is a website called The American Muslim, where this wonderful woman, Sheila Musaji, has actually gone through and collected, because people got so tired of hearing about that. So you can find all of the worldwide condemnations as well as the ones in the United States. But back to the question, I think it really, the factor, I think, more than theology is socioeconomic and when people kind of got here. So in the more recent immigrant communities, do you have more conservatism? In the communities that are more active in interfaith, in politics, the ones that have been around for a longer time, and I mean, you can go through and name certain mosques that fit that kind of perspective, that's where you see more openness. So I know with regard to the ICCNC, I mean, they have a scholarship fund that is being supported by Sunnis across the Bay Area. They have events that, Zahra and me attend regularly. That's pretty unprecedented, and you wouldn't have that same openness in more recent immigrants because they're just not used to it. So a lot of it is like any immigrant community, when you got here, is it the grandmother or is it the grandchild?
When and from where?
To some extent as well, but I think more when and your level of education, socioeconomic. So there's so many factors that people don't think of. They're only looking at the religion, but there's a lot of other things that come into play.
And we'll bring our listeners into play here and go to a first caller, Humaira. Good morning.
Hi, thank you for having me this morning.
You're welcome.
I just wanted to give a comment, quick one, about moving to communities which have higher Muslim populations or not. I moved to Pleasanton 15 years ago, and my friends were very anxious on my behalf because they were afraid I'm moving to a town which has maybe 10 Muslim families. I will be faced with a lot of, cold shoulders. People might not be so friendly. And all their fears were not true. We were welcomed with open arms. My kids were invited to play dates, and we had lots of friends and, played in the park for 2 hours. 15 years later, now what I see is with my youngest one going through that phase, people are very nice. They say hi to you, but that's where it ends. The trying to reach out and accept you and or try to get to know you, that does not happen.
And what do you think has changed specifically, Humaira? How do you read that?
I just think that the media played a really big role, and people have learned maybe things that are not true for all communities, and especially our religion has been labeled with so many terrorists and all those type of things that I think that has affected people's thinking a lot. My kids, especially, who were in middle school and high school, faced a lot of comments about, oh, you being a terrorist, or you coming from a background, support, these kind of influences. Even some comments from teachers, which I found very hurtful. And that really did bother me. Amina Dhanali played a big role in that. She helped me introduce the teacher and bring ING to schools, but if the teacher is not willing to bring in or open curriculum, then we cannot really push her.
Let me bring Zahra Bilo into this. How much are we seeing the media playing a kind of role in what this caller is describing, making it harder for Muslims?
So it's interesting because we're in a positive media setting right now as we have this conversation, and I don't know the numbers immediately, but I do know that right now the most recent studies do show that when religion comes up in mainstream media conversation, Islam is one of the foremost religions that gets mentioned on a frequent basis, and that an overwhelming percentage of mentions of Islam are negative. And I think that that's always a concern, right? Is that we're not portraying American Muslims as human beings who maybe are celebrating one of their biggest holidays tomorrow. we're talking about terrorism, we're talking about jihad, we're talking about international politics. One of the main comparisons that always comes up is that when someone commits a crime, you don't consider their religion. It never comes up unless they're Muslim. And it comes up whether they're robbing a bank or killing someone. And that's not true for really any other individual.
Let me thank the caller. And did you want to add something, Payman Amiri?
Yes, I just want to bring this. I think at least local media could focus on positive things that Muslims are doing here. And for instance, I want to put a plug for this. We started a couple of years ago. On September 11, every year, Muslim organization across Bay Area volunteer in for social welfare programs. Our center last year volunteered at Glide Memorial Church. The entire day was taken over by volunteers from our center, and I'm sure all the Islamic centers and organizations did the same thing. So this is something that us as Americans who practice Islam find that our social responsibility on this day to go out and take a day off from our regular life and volunteer and help others, and not only Muslims, but all human beings. So I think we should focus on these positive things, and if we do this, we'll have a different view of Muslims in this country.
It's also generally true, I think, and I'm certain everybody here realizes, that this is a country that was founded presumably on religious freedom, and therefore and has had a kind of pluralistic ethos all along. So religious intolerance is frowned on, and yet in the media you hear this kind of stuff stirred up, particularly on certain stations. Let me go to more of your calls. Mary, joining us from Daly City. Morning, Mary.
Thank you for taking my call. On the issue of Sharia, I would like to strongly disagree with the way some guests, and I think even this Michael Krasny, has characterized the situation. I urge everyone listening to actually read the sample of cases that can be found at Sharia Law and American Courts. I can give the website in a minute. None of these cases involve things like what Muslims eat at home, what Jews eat at home, or Catholic catechism, how you teach your religion to your children. All of these cases involve serious conflicts between the way certain states' laws on alimony, custody, marital rape, and so forth. And there certainly are cases which I urge people to actually read rather than talk about in an uninformed way. There certainly are cases in that very small sample in which women, usually Muslim women, were deprived of custody, their children were deprived of contact with their mother because a state court, a secular court, not arbitration or some private religious function, but a secular state court, either at the trial or appellate level, decided to honor a particular interpretation of Islamic law on custody, alimony, divorce, marital rape, and the like, rather than follow the law of the state that would apply to everyone else, like how alimony is decided, how custody is decided, how visitation is decided, how marital rape is decided. Instead of pontificating that this is just a fear of how people teach their children at home or what they eat at home because of their religious teachings, these are serious conflicts between secular state laws on custody, divorce, visitation, marital rape, and a number of other issues, and which, in some cases, not all cases, indeed, women and children were deprived of the rights that other women and children in this country would have because a state court, either at the trial or appellate level, decided to honor a particular interpretation.
All right, ma'am, let me break in here because I think...
And I can give the website.
I'll ask you for that in a moment, but I want to get Amina Jindali to respond here. I think you were talking about... you were describing Sharia largely in terms of practice and ritual and food preparation and all that sort of thing. I mean, she has a point. There are, you know, marital and custody issues that come under Sharia that conflict with secular law.
Right. I mean, what I'm talking about is throwing the baby out with the bathwater. I mean, you can't throw out an entire corpus of law because some people in certain states are using that in place of traditional law that would actually apply. But I'm going to actually defer to Zahra because she's an attorney and she's much more aware of the nuances here.
I was just going to say, it really is a First Amendment question. The things that the caller is concerned about, be they child custody or marital rape, are already prohibited by U.S. law. There is a principle in Sharia that requires that Muslims abide by the law of the land that they live in. So where marital rape is already against criminal law, and where mainstream Muslim scholars have said that this is a sin, this is prohibited in Islam, it's not really a threat. What the movement, American Law for American Courts, is doing is taking a few cases where judges made mistakes, were later overturned, overstepped their bounds by, the caller's right, by trying to pontificate Islamic law in an American court, and using that to throw the baby out with the bathwater. And so the First Amendment protects against this. The First Amendment prohibits states from unnecessarily entangling themselves in religious discussions.
Mary, you want to give out that website?
About the website, and I want to reiterate, it is not the case that these were all overturned. There were absolutely cases, and one can go and read them for themselves, in which they were not overturned. They were upheld, and women were deprived of the custody rights, and children were deprived of contact with their mother because of these interpretations. It is not true that the court always said, oh, we made a mistake, let us overturn that. That is simply not true, and I urge people to actually read the cases for themselves, which, again, are a small sample. No, by no means represents all the cases in which it has happened that women, ironically, often Muslim women, have been deprived of rights that they would have normally as American citizens in terms of alimony, custody, and so forth.
Kindly give us the website.
The website is shariainamericancourts.com.
Okay, and thank you for your call. Good to hear from you. We'll hear from some more of our listeners. We'll go to Colin in San Francisco. Good morning.
Good morning. Unfortunately, I don't have a website. However, I would like to disagree with the prior caller and express my dismay with how the media has labeled all Muslims with one brush. Basically, I think that the diversity of viewpoints within the Muslim community has been ignored. There's a lot of, particularly Sufism with other more reform aspects of Judaism and Christianity that are things that would not cause so much concern. I would just like to guess comment on that. Why do you think that there's been so little brought up about the more reform parts of the Muslim community? It seems that the media sort of has tarred all Muslims with a brush that they support honor killings and more reactionary.
Let me ask Jess Ganim about that. Do you think, Professor Ganim, there's been a kind of short shrift given to the more moderate voices in the Muslim community generally by the media?
Well,
present media accepted, of course.
Yeah, present media accepted, of course. But, moderate Muslims don't make good sound bites. I mean, the reality is, and the caller's quite correct, it's a very diverse community. There are lots of points of view. It happens to be there's a mainstream view of Islam in this country, which does not make it to the mainstream media at all. And as I said, it doesn't, moderate voices are not great sound bites on network television because it sounds very, reasonable and understanding and, consistent with the values that we have in this country. So, we're grateful that we have this opportunity to speak on this show, obviously, because you're hearing voices within the community that represent a pretty significant and large segment of the community. And you can tell by what we're all saying is that we're pretty mainstream when it comes to our views and our understanding of Islam in this country and in the Bay Area. But, outside of this show, I'm not sure any of us would make great sound bites for anywhere else on the media.
Well, let me go to some of our listeners' sound bites. At least they come in that form sometimes when they're posted on the web or when they come through emails. Here's William, who says, I'd like your guest to speak a little more about the Sharia law and its place in the United States. I do not agree with the ban. However, I was always under the impression that we only have one system of law here, and that's the Constitution. Yeah. Constitution is the core of our American values, and no law should be allowed to exist in conflict with it. And I think essentially what you said in response to that before, Zahra Billou, is there is no conflict as you see it.
Right.
And these laws, therefore, are superfluous as you see it?
Absolutely. I mean, in that Americans do, even when they abide by the Constitution, have the right to agree to private contracts. So as an example, I'm a newlywed. My marital contract was governed by Sharia, such that it's still not in conflict with the Constitution. So I couldn't put anything in my marital contract that would be in conflict with California law. But I could choose how I'm going to divide up my assets, how we're going to enter into the marriage, all according to Islamic law, and there is no conflict there. So there are spaces that are created for Muslims, Christians, Jews, and really just private individuals who want to engage sort of with additional rules.
American law is Trump, though. I mean, it would be, let's say, if someone from the Mormon faith, and this is not very common in the Mormon faith anymore, believed in polygamy, would not have that license to be a newlywed like you and then a newlywed again right
Absolutely.
After
Absolutely. American law trumps. And that's what I meant, is that the things that are prohibited, American Muslims believe that they are required to abide by regardless.
Here's another listener, Rick, though, who says, The Economist magazine had a survey about the justice issues in several Muslim countries. The survey showed that well over half the people in such countries as Pakistan, Turkey, and many others felt that an adulterer should be stoned to death. Or another question was the penalty for a Muslim to convert away from this faith, death. I'm curious to know what your guests think about this and also how they would explain this mindset and also how this could be integrated into Western society, or maybe if it could be. Payman Amiri, get you on record here.
Well, I know this issue was discussed extensively at our center to educate non-Muslims about some of these practices that they think it's Islamic. And at least the scholars, the Muslim scholars that we brought in at our center were totally against these stoning. And so some of these interpretations And it's misunderstood. And
it's also a difference between what goes on in other parts of the world under the rubric of Islam and what is extant here in the United States, isn't it?
Right. And so, but even in those countries, I think it's a lot of these things are, you know, political systems take advantage of Islam to whatever they want to do, and they give it Islamic, so it's saying Islamic law, and then and it's easier for them to justify certain things that happens in these countries. So, but Amina and Zahra probably could
I mean, as I explained to the students in my class, the bar for stoning, which is actually not in the Quran, it's in the Old Testament. The Quran does not mention stoning. It mentions 100 lashes. But you cannot press that unless you have four eyewitnesses, which is pretty much impossible. And we're talking about four eyewitnesses in the room with the couple. So all of these cases across the world are very suspect. Are these people really following the letter of the law? So this law is a more symbolic law if it's practiced properly, because it's impossible to really proceed. And even accusing a woman of an indiscretion, you yourself are actually susceptible to punishment, which is almost the same as the person that you're accusing. So,
well, you don't hear too much about that media, do you?
You don't. So a lot of this is cultural.
A lot of it's misogyny, is really.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Let me get another caller on. Elizabeth, we welcome you to the program. Good morning.
Hello. You know, I don't know what your guests are talking about, the interpretation of Sharia law or symbolic laws. You know, I never thought I would have anything in common with the folks in Dearborn, Michigan, but their fear of that law is somewhat reasonable. If you look at the language itself, it is very black and white. It's very clear that women can be stoned, that converts can be put to death.
Where is this clear? Which text?
If you look directly,
can you give the text?
At Sharia law, if I can finish, please. Yes. Also, I represented a convert, an apostate, about a year ago in immigration court, and we applied for protection under the Convention Against Torture, and we won that case. I knew nothing about Sharia law until I took this case on, and I had to read provisions of the law. And not only did I read provisions of the law, but I learned that in Muslim countries, they definitely, it's not just interpretation or symbolic. For instance, in Egypt, they will kill you if you are a convert. Not only will they kill you, they will kill and go after the attorney that represents that convert in Egypt. So So, again, this is not interpretation. This is not symbolic. Also, there's a long history of the way Egypt treats their Christians and Coptics. That is all out of Sharia law. Sharia law has some very dangerous provisions in it that are actually put into effect. And you can just pop it up on the internet, go into a search engine, put in Sharia law, Egypt, or any other country, especially on the way they deal with converts or apostates, and you will see that it is a dangerous law. And maybe it trumps, you know, American law trumps Sharia law, but still, you know, there's a conflict there because there's also the issue of freedom of religion.
Let me hear from Zahra Bilal on this. We'll go to the lawyer here.
So I think Amina asked the question of the caller. I'm curious to know if she read a specific document that was titled Sharia law, because I don't think Amina and I have ever seen a specific document titled that way. And I'm not poking fun. Like, I think that it's really important that if people are getting on Google and searching for things about religions that they're not very familiar with, that they be cautious of what they read. It sounds to me like she was describing Egyptian law. And I think it's important for callers to remember that Egypt just went through a historic revolution where people overcame an oppressive government that had been prosecuting cases and implementing laws for decades that they didn't agree with.
Are we also talking about the difference between what is done under the name of Sharia as opposed to
what is
Sharia law as it's written?
Right, absolutely. I mean, was she reading the Quran and the teachings of the Prophet, or was she, again, reading some Egyptian statute? And that's all been thrown out for the most part. At the same time, it's important to note that, you know, she talks about Christian and Muslim issues in Egypt, and some of the best examples of interfaith harmony in recent months have been during these revolutions in other countries, with Christians protecting Egyptians and Egyptians protecting Christians during the revolution.
There's been, unfortunately, a lot of violence, though, against Coptic Christians in Egypt.
I mean, absolutely. I don't disagree. And that's been condemned by mainstream Muslim scholars in the United States and many other parts of the world.
Well, we have a little bit of time left here. It boils down to, again, a tale of two cities, doesn't it? A split decision or something along those lines. We can only hope that relations between the Muslim and non-Muslim community will continue to improve and get better as the years from 9/11 recede. Thank you all for the work that you do, and appreciate your being with us this morning. Jess Ganim, again, is Professor of Clinical Psychiatry and Global Health at UCSF and a board member of the National Association of Arab Americans. Amina Jandali is founding member of the Islamic Network Group, and Zahra Bilal is executive director of the Council on American Islamic Relations, San Francisco Bay Area Chapter of CARE. And Payman Amiri is trustee member of the Islamic Cultural Center of Northern California. Thank you, our guests. Thank you, our listeners. We wouldn't be here without you. And thanks to our senior editor, Dan Zoll, and our producers, Kevin Guillory, Judy Campbell, Tina Lauerberg, and Amy Machado. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.